In 1960, a new prescription medication was introduced that was so important, so powerful, that it didn't even really need a name. Everyone just called it the pill. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Affordable, reliable birth control that didn't depend on a partner's consent was something women all over the world desired. But it wasn't a priority for the medical establishment, for pharmaceutical companies, and certainly not for policymakers. This hour, the birth control revolution and the people who made it possible. I'll talk with Jonathan Eig, the author of The Birth of the Pill, How Four Crusaders Reinvented Sex and Launched a Revolution. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. On May 9th, 1960, the birth control pill was approved by the FDA, and all women had to do to get it was ask their doctor for a prescription. For many people, that moment is the beginning of the story. The pill gave women power and freedom, and it changed a great deal about our society. But the story began many years before that moment. And this hour, my guest is Jonathan Eig. He's the author of The Birth of the Pill, How Four Crusaders Reinvented Sex and Launched a Revolution. Hello, Jonathan.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
And there are many more than four people who are really involved in the development of the birth control pill, but you've chosen to focus on the four biggest players in this movement. And I want to start with Margaret Sanger. And her story starts a long time before 1960. Tell me a little bit about her.
Margaret Sanger is really the person who has this idea that there ought to be a way for women to control their fertility with modern science, that they ought to be able to turn on and off their reproductive systems. And this idea comes from a lifetime of experience. By the time the 1950s arrive and she actually begins to work on the pill, she's in her 70s. But it begins with her own childhood, where she sees her mother die at a very early age after having given birth to 11 children, where Margaret becomes a nurse and goes to work in the slums of New York City in the tenements on the Lower East Side, and sees women having more children than they can bear, dying from either the process of giving birth or from abortions that are performed in back alleys by unqualified doctors, and she decides to devote her life to this idea that women need to know how to control their own bodies, how they'll never have control of their lives if they can't control their bodies. She also believes that women should be allowed to have sex for fun, that it should be about more than just reproduction. And this becomes her lifelong mission. But for 40 years, she can't find anybody who thinks that the stance of creating a birth control pill. That just sounds like science fiction to everybody. But she hangs on to this dream for all of her life, really, hoping that she'll have somebody who might agree with her that this is something that they could do, that they could pull off.
Well, and she also was very committed to making other kinds of contraception available to women long before the birth control pill came about. In 1916, she opened the first birth control clinic in the United States. And describe for us a little bit about what kind of environment she was doing this in, because there were laws in place in the United States and pretty much everywhere that made everything she was doing illegal.
That's right. In the United States, there's federal law and state laws in most states saying that you could not give out birth control to women. You could not even give out information about birth control. It was considered part of the Pornography Act, and it was seen birth control was seen as something that promoted promiscuity, and there were laws against it. So she went to jail several times for defying those laws and for handing out information about birth control. There really weren't a lot of great options available to women as contraception back in these days. You know, there were condoms, obviously, and there were IUDs and diaphragms, but they were very ineffective. They were not well made, and they required you know, doctor's permission. Really, doctors were only supposed to prescribe them in cases of medical need, not for lifestyle issues. And trying to control the size of your family was not a good enough reason to get birth control, according to the law at the time. So Sanger was opening these clinics first in New York and then all around the country and eventually around the world. But she was doing it as a rebel, as an outsider, somebody who really had to take extraordinary risks to accomplish these things.
Well, and she had said when she was very young and pursuing her education and developing her ideas and getting acquainted with the world that she thought that marriage was akin to suicide. But she did get married and she did become a mother. But she also did not allow herself to pursue that in a traditional way.
Yeah, Sanger's an incredibly complicated woman, and it makes her story so interesting. She really didn't believe in marriage, but she got married. She thought that having kids would destroy her ability to crusade for this issue, but she had kids anyway. And then she really sort of ignored her family. She had affairs. She encouraged her husband to have affairs. She wound up divorced. She paid very little attention to her children, and at one point facing arrest, she moved to Europe and left her children back home to be cared for by her husband and by an aunt. And she was always deeply conflicted about this, but she felt like her career, her mission, came before her family.
As she was trying to communicate with women everywhere about her mission and people everywhere about her mission, it strikes me that for a lot of people, she was not a very relatable person. I mean, she was a very attractive person. She was very charismatic. But I would guess a lot of people just took a great deal of offense to her.
In some ways, yes, because she was living in this incredibly exciting world, you know, hanging out with intellectuals and making love to men seemingly at random whenever the mood struck her. This was not the kind of normal existence that most women in America or anywhere else really were enjoying. At the same time, she was fighting to give women something so important and something they so desperately craved that I think most mainstream women didn't care a bit what she was doing with her personal life, as long as they could help them avoid getting pregnant. Women were so desperate for any kind of help. If you've got 9 or 10 children and you really can't afford or don't think your body can handle having an 11th, you're not too worried about whether the person who's helping you control your family size is having affairs or not. You're more interested in the bottom line and the practical effects on your own life.
You printed she received so many letters from women all over the place, and you printed one of them that she really received from New Jersey in January 5th of 1925. Dear Mrs. Sanger, I received your pamphlet on family limitation. I am 30 years old, and I've been married 14 years. I have 11 children. The oldest is 13, the youngest 1 year. I have kidney and heart disease. Every one of my children is defective, and we are very poor. Now, Mrs. Sanger, can you please help me? And it's a difficult letter to read because there are a lot of grammatical errors, but she said at one point, my doctor said I will surely go insane if I keep this up, but I can't help it. And the doctor won't do anything for me. And she closes with, you are a mother and you know, so please pity me and help me. Please, please. And this is just an example of how many letters do you think she got from women all over the world?
Well, I read hundreds, and I'm sure there must have been thousands. And that's not to mention, you know, the many personal encounters she had working as a nurse and meeting these women and having them walk into her clinics. And the part of the issue was that these women felt like they could not say no to their husbands when the husbands wanted sex, and that if they did have sex, they really, you know, had very little way to avoid becoming pregnant. And when they did get pregnant, there were no options, really. They were expected to stay home and take care of these children no matter how many they had. And that's part of the problem. The men didn't really care. It didn't make a big difference to the man whether he had 10 or 11 children, but it made a very big difference to the women. And Sanger was the only hope for a lot of these women. They didn't see anyone else out there fighting for them on their behalf.
Now, Of course, she founded the American Birth Control League, which later became Planned Parenthood. And we'll talk more about that organization in a little while. But I want to shift to one of the other mavericks that you write about who's involved in this creation. And his name is Gregory Goodwin Pincus. And he is a fascinating character. He's a biologist and a researcher. And when Sanger goes to him, he doesn't have a great reputation. What has happened to him?
Yeah, it's another great, fascinating part of the story, and you wonder how this ever worked, how they ever got the pill, given the astounding odds that any of this would come off. But Sanger by now is in her 70s. It's 1950, and she's been saying for 40 years, what I really need is a miracle tablet, something that women could take quietly, surreptitiously, without telling their men, something they could take every day so they didn't have to fumble with it before sex, and something when they wanted to get pregnant again, they could stop taking it, and just like that, they'd be ready to become pregnant. Everybody she meets tells her this is nuts, it'll never happen, you're dreaming. And in 1950, she meets Gregory Pincus, and Pincus has been fired from Harvard, denied tenure, I should say, because he was too radical. In the 1930s, he was working on in vitro fertilization. And he had it exactly right, knew exactly how it would work and the impact it would have on the world someday. But it was too soon. The world was not ready for this, and it scared people. They thought that we'd be talking about Brave New World kind of babies in bottles. And he couldn't find work after Harvard denied him tenure. He was forced to start his own laboratory in a garage, go door to door in his community of Worcester, Massachusetts, to raise money to support his work. And he was an incredible genius who felt like the world did not appreciate his brilliance, and that someday he would prove to them that he was capable of greatness. And when he meets Margaret Sanger, and Sanger says, "I have this vision for a birth control pill," Pincus says, "Oh, I could do that." and you could just imagine how stunned Sanger must have been, because everyone else had said no. Pincus says, "Oh, it would be easy. If you've got the money, I can do it." And then he goes on to explain the science behind how a birth control would work off the top of his head. He's never researched a birth control pill before. Nobody has, really, because it seems crazy. Even if you could make one, who would manufacture it? Would the government ever allow it? You know, this is really astounding odds. But Pincus had nothing to lose, and that was the key.
He was just crazy enough to make it happen.
That's right.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We are talking about the creation of the birth control pill. My guest is Jonathan Eig. He's the author of The Birth of the Pill, How Four Crusaders Reinvented Sex and Launched a Revolution. And we've gotten up to the moment in about 1950 when Margaret Sanger approached the scientist Gregory Goodwin Pincus. We'll pick up on that story in just a moment. It was a wild ride. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the development of the birth control pill. Jonathan Eig has written about this amazing story in his book, The Birth of the Pill, How Four Crusaders Reinvented Sex and Launched a Revolution. And Jonathan, just before the break, we got to the point where Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, had approached a scientist with a shady reputation, Gregory Goodwin Pincus, and talk to him about the possibility of a birth control pill, and in a moment of arrogance, I guess, and supreme optimism, he said, "Yeah, I can do that." Tell me a little bit about where he was working, because he got drummed out of Harvard and then he started his own foundation. But this wasn't really the most reputable foundation that he put together. Tell me a little bit about it.
Well, I wouldn't say it was disreputable. I would say it was a risky startup, and he and another scientist had founded this thing completely independent. They had no support from university. They were applying for government grants, applying for grants from drug companies, and literally knocking on doors in Worcester, Massachusetts, going to the local bowling alley, going to the tailor shops, the dry cleaners and saying, would you contribute $25 a year to support this new public institution?
And you know, that sounds very 1990s. How
sounds,
common
sounds
was
very,
that in
very
1950?
Public radio too, doesn't
right, it?
It
does.
But it was completely unique. There was nothing else like this. Nobody had ever tried this before. But this was the dawn of the new age of science, where Americans were so excited about the possibilities of that science could deliver. Science had just won the war. Science was conquering polio. So why couldn't every community have its own scientific research center? And why shouldn't the public support that, given the good that science would do for the world? And it was fighting diseases. It was so much excitement in the 50s that, and Pincus was this incredibly confident man who really helped the people of Worcester believe that this was an important mission to pursue, even though they didn't really understand the work he was doing. They just said, well, science, what hormone research? It sounds good, you know. Here's a check. give it a shot. And Pincus, for the rest of his career, really would scrape together a living this way. He would keep the Worcester Foundation going for decades to come, by really his own personal genius and magnetism. And this is how he got Margaret Sanger on board. He said, if you've got the money, I can give you a birth control pill. And he explained, he was very good at explaining in layman's terms how science worked. He said, and this is so important that he had this immediate epiphany, but he said the body already has a birth control device. It's called progesterone. And when a woman's pregnant, the reason she doesn't get pregnant again is to protect that baby that's growing. Her body releases a hormone called progesterone, and that sends the message that no more ovulation should occur. And so if we could just simulate that and trick the woman's body into thinking that it's already pregnant, if we give the woman progesterone in the form of an injection or a tablet, her body will think it's pregnant, and she won't get pregnant again, and that's your birth control pill.
So he said, if you've got the money, I can make it happen. But getting the money wasn't that easy either, because at this point, Margaret Sanger is no longer the president of Planned Parenthood, and the people who are in charge at Planned Parenthood think that this is a pretty risky endeavor.
It is a risky endeavor. Think about what could go wrong. I mean, women could die. You're giving this pill to healthy young women. If Pincus is even able to make the pill and to get someone to manufacture it, there's never been anything like this before. There's never been a pill for healthy people in the world. You don't take a risk giving experimental drugs to people who are healthy. You do it to cure disease. You do it to fight pain. But this is completely different and very risky. So Planned Parenthood says, no, we don't want any part of this. We'll stick to what we're doing, running clinics and educating women. We'll leave the scientific experiments to somebody else. So Sanger has to now find another way to get money to support Pincus. I mean, she doesn't have much time left. She's 71 years old. She's had several heart attacks already. She thinks this is her last chance to see this come to fruition.
So she gets him about $2,000.
Yeah,
to start.
She finds $2,000 from Planned Parenthood, and then after that, Planned Parenthood starts to hedge about even that level of commitment. But Pincus knows, and I'm sure Sanger knows, that this is going to require many tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars by 1950 standards.
Right. So Pincus has this idea about progesterone, and he immediately starts experimenting with rabbits and with rats, and things go really well, don't they?
Yeah, it works in the rabbits and the rats anyway. The progesterone definitely shuts down ovulation, so the rabbits and rats are not getting pregnant, and that's great news. They're not dropping dead either, which is really important. And then the next question is, obviously, will it work in humans? And that's where things get really interesting.
Well, and we also, let's talk a little bit more about money, because as you said, everybody knows that there needs to be more money put into this project. So there is another woman, she's even older than Margaret Sanger, that is interested in supporting this research, and that's Catherine McCormick. And tell me a little bit, just briefly, about her. She has such a fascinating history as well.
She's another real hero in this story, and a reminder that nothing really happens without money, and money often requires individuals to make a commitment. And And Catherine McCormick grew up very wealthy in Chicago. She married an even wealthier man, Stanley McCormick, who was the heir to the International Harvester fortune. His father had invented the Reaper, was one of the wealthiest families in the world. And right after their marriage, on their honeymoon, her husband went mad and had to be institutionalized.
He had a psychotic break.
Psychotic break, and really was not even able to stay in the home. He had to be institutionalized in a private mental hospital that Catherine built for him in California, hired a full team of doctors and nurses, even built a laboratory for the first study of apes, of monkeys and apes in this country, because doctors believed they could find a cure by experimenting on animals for him. And Catherine herself was a science major at MIT, one of the first women to graduate from MIT with a degree in science. So she became very involved in seeking a cure for her husband's mental illness, and learned a great deal about hormone research in the process. And when her husband died and left her an enormous fortune, she got in touch with Margaret Sanger, someone she had known as a young woman, and said she was interested in getting back to work on this birth control work issue that she had worked on, many decades earlier. And she offered to support whatever kind of work there was if Sanger needed any money.
And Pincus got pretty excited about this, too.
Oh, yeah. Who wouldn't, right? I mean, he's been going around scraping together $25 at a time from local merchants. And now here's one of the wealthiest women in the world offering to not only to write him checks, but to build him a new facility for all of his research, to create a new building to house all the animals. Until now, he's been keeping the animals in the attic and in the basement of this home where he's working. So suddenly, Catherine McCormick comes along, and he's got an opportunity here to do some big work because he's got a blank check, basically.
Now, he'd been doing his research, as I mentioned before, with rabbits and rats, and things were extremely promising as far as using progesterone to stop ovulation. And at this point, he feels he's ready for human tests. And that was in 1952. So he basically started this research in 1950. In 1952, he thinks it's time to start experimenting on women. That seems pretty radical.
He's moving fast, and for good reason. I mean, his two major benefactors are both old and frail. And if either one of them dies, his work is done. There's no one else to pay for this. He's gotten really very few options. And the other thing is that he knows it's controversial. He knows that at any point, the government, the Catholic Church, some pharmaceutical company might get wind of this and put the kibosh on it. So he's an outsider. He's not working for Harvard, where he's got tenure and a steady paycheck. He's got to make this happen fast because it could all fall apart at any time.
I'm talking with Jonathan Eich. He's the author of The Birth of the Pill, How Four Crusaders Reinvented Sex and Launched a Revolution. So Pincus is looking for a doctor that he can work with to do this research on women. And he's got concerns about the doctor that he approaches. He wants somebody who's not associated with the birth control movement. He wants somebody that people will trust. He's also looking for a doctor that is not Jewish, because Pincus himself was Jewish and felt that people had discriminated against him on that basis. And he finds a doctor that seems like the most unlikely ally ever. That's Dr. John Rock. He's a devout Catholic, and he works to help women get pregnant. How did they make that connection?
Yeah, I love this. This is the odd couple, Pincus and Rock. And, Pincus is a brilliant biologist, but he's never treated women, has no idea how to really conduct an exam, so he needs a gynecologist. And just so happens that Pincus is in Worcester and John Rock is in Boston at Harvard. He's perhaps the most respected gynecologist in New England, one of the most respected in the world, and he's a Catholic to boot. And Pincus has met him at conferences over the years, and he says to Rock, I'm thinking about these experiments with progesterone. I think it could really work as a fertility treatment, something that would as a contraceptive. because it could, you know, it mimics the functions of the body. It's a natural hormone. We understand more about hormones now. And Rock, to Pincus's astonishment, says, oh, I've already tried giving some progesterone to some of my patients. And Rock, has, it turns out, has tried progesterone to give women cycles a rest, to rest their women who are coming to him who are infertile, who are desperate to have babies. Rock says, well, let's try some progesterone. It'll shut down your ovulation for a few months. Maybe at that rest will do you some good. And then when you start ovulating again, it'll be like a jump start, you know, a rebound.
Right. And he feels like this will, he has a theory that maybe the woman's reproductive system is not fully mature, and sort of tricking her body into feeling like she's pregnant will help it mature and then help her become pregnant.
That's exactly right. So Pincus is astonished by this, to find that somebody's already tried this on humans. Great news, they didn't drop dead. They didn't suffer any horrible side effects, except for the fact that they all thought they were pregnant because the progesterone, these were injections at the time, caused some dizziness and some bloating and some migraines and nausea. And these are symptoms of pregnancy often. So the women became very excited, calling Rock, saying, yeah, I know you told me it was impossible, but I'm pregnant. And Rock had to break the news to them that this was just a side effect of the progesterone. But Pincus said, well, what if we kept it up? What if we kept giving it to women for longer to really just test that it's absolutely shutting down ovulation, that it's 100% effective, that it's not unsafe? This could be a way for us to begin our human trials. And Rock signed on. Rock agreed to do it, in part because he really thought that women, that the Catholic Church was wrong on this issue, that women really did need birth control, that they should be able to have sex as part of a happy, healthy marriage for fun and not just for making babies. And he also saw so many women coming into his office having their eighth and ninth child, and saw how hard it was for many of them, especially the poorer women, and he wanted something to help.
So he knew that they were testing birth control, but the women who then later enrolled in this study did not know that.
That is true. There were a lot of actions that Sanger and Pincus and Rock took that today would never be allowed, because they're unethical, because these women were not given were not asked to provide informed consent. They didn't know that this was experimental. They didn't know that they were subjects, and we could never get away with that today. But that is how they proceeded, and those were within the normal ethical standards of the 1950s. Pincus and Rock were not doing anything that would have been considered unethical at the time.
Now, they felt that the results of this first 3-month study were maybe encouraging, but they're testing birth control on women who were struggling with infertility anyway. So what did they actually find out from those first studies? I mean, if those women didn't get pregnant, they weren't going to get pregnant anyway, probably.
But they were able to see, first of all, that it was safe, that the women weren't suffering, they were suffering side effects, but nothing too serious, at least in the minds of these men, and they could see that the women were not ovulating. So that was very important, because it showed that the progesterone did, in fact, inhibit ovulation, and that was really the key. That was really all they needed to know. And then the next step would be trying to find some women who were actually having sex, who were trying to get pregnant, who were fertile. But they were just trying to patch this together as best they could now. And remember, this was all illegal. If they called it birth control, they could never have gotten away with it. It's certainly not in Massachusetts, which had very strict laws on its books.
Absolutely. And before we get to the break, I want to go to the phones. This is Fritz in Plattsville, Wisconsin. Hi, Fritz.
Yes.
And we were talking earlier about Margaret Sanger, and
yes,
you wanted to bring up an issue that a lot of people wonder about with Margaret Sanger. What are you concerned about?
Well, I've read about her a number of different places, and was there not a significant racial component to her original work?
That's a great question, and it's really messy. She definitely allied herself with the eugenics movement, which was interested in controlling fertility for a very different reason. They believed that wealthy, white, educated families should be encouraged to have more children, and that poor minority families, uneducated people, illiterates, should be discouraged from having children. And they believed that birth control was one way to improve the gene pool of our world by going in that direction, by helping the so-called good families have more children and the unwanted, undesirable families to have fewer. And Sanger definitely made allies with those folks. I don't believe it was out of racism on her part, because she also operated in Harlem and opened clinics there and worked very closely with minorities. But I do believe that she saw it as something convenient. I believe she made a sort of an ethical compromise on her own part, because it helped her cause. She was looking for allies anywhere she could get them. And it is one of the stains on Margaret Sanger's legacy, but it also has to be understood, you know, in the context of the 1930s and 40s, when she was working, even in the 50s, when she was working with eugenicists. Eugenics was a mainstream movement. It was taught at Harvard. It was not as clear an ethical choice as it would be today.
Fritz, thank you so much for bringing that up. I think it also speaks to the fact that Sanger was so committed to this idea. She wanted to make it happen no matter what the cost.
That's right. And if it meant breaking a few eggs or even staining her own reputation,
right,
she was willing to do that. And the same was true for these men, willing to put these side effects on women. And eventually they go and test it in mental hospitals in the slums of Puerto Rico.
And we'll talk about that.
But the point is that these men also believe that they were absolutely focused on the bottom line, just as Sanger was, and that if we could give the world this birth control pill, it would be worth whatever risks and whatever side effects we incur along the way.
I'm talking with Jonathan Eig. He's the author of The Birth of the Pill. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with Jonathan Eig. He is the author of The Birth of the Pill, How Four Crusaders Reinvented Sex and Launched a Revolution. We have been introduced to all of the key players in this story: Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood; Gregory Goodwin Pincus, a biologist and a researcher who'd been drummed out of Harvard; Catherine McCormick, a social activist and millionaire; and Dr. John Rock, a Catholic, devout Catholic fertility doctor. And we were just, before the break, we were talking about those first human trials. And I think everyone realized after those first human trials that they needed to find more women, get a larger group. But they looked in all the wrong places. I mean, they thought about Puerto Rico, but when they searched out women in Puerto Rico, they were looking for women who were in nursing school and women that they felt they could coerce into being a part of the study, because the study was not an easy one. You had to submit a lot of samples, and nobody really enjoys doing that on a daily basis. But they did just seem to look in all the wrong places, didn't they?
They did, and I think some of that is just a matter of class bias. These are educated, Harvard-educated men, for the most part, running these studies. Sanger and McCormick are in their 70s and out of touch with society. None of them had ever really, Sanger hadn't been in the streets working in the tenements for, 50 years. And it hadn't occurred to them that women might be clamoring for this pill. They might be lining up to participate in these clinical studies if they found the right community. And that happened almost accidentally, because they did decide that Puerto Rico was the place to try to launch their big study. They needed to test this thing on hundreds, if not thousands, of women.
Right. And was Puerto Rico the place because they wouldn't be subject to the laws that prevented them from doing it in the United States?
That's right. They looked at other countries as well. They looked at Japan and Mexico, and they were trying to get around the very conservative laws in the United States. But almost accidentally, Pincus gave a lecture in Puerto Rico and realized that there were a lot of American-trained doctors and nurses down there. It was a lot closer to fly to there than it would be to Japan, and he could control the work himself and keep tabs on it. And they initially began by trying to get nursing students at the University of Puerto Rico to sign up, and they even threatened them that if the women refused to participate, they would receive bad grades, that their professors would take points away from them. And even then, they couldn't get women to do it because the side effects were just terrible. At this point, the early doses of the pill were many, many times higher than they really needed to be, and that's because Pincus wanted to make sure that it was effective. So he just absolutely ramped up much too high the levels of progesterone in these things. So women might agree to try it, but then they would be so nauseous and have so many headaches that they dropped out very quickly. But while they were working in Puerto Rico, one of the nurses said, you know, you're going about this all wrong. The people who need this are out in the slums. And if we could offer them a way to improve their contraceptive options, I think you'll have lines around the block for this thing, even if it does cause nausea. These women, you know, the average family size in Puerto Rico was something like 7.1 children per woman, and they were desperate. So when they finally moved out into the slums and started offering them in clinics out in the poorer areas of San Juan, then they found their test subjects.
All right. And this was not all smooth sailing easy either, because, of course, the main religion in Puerto Rico is Catholicism. And the Catholic Church has been very clear for a very long time about their stance on any kind of birth control or contraception. So what happened once the church found out what was going on?
It was interesting because once the church found out, there would be these sermons on Sundays in church, and the priests would say, we've heard that these American doctors and nurses are down here and that they're offering and they're talking to you about these new form of birth control, and we wanted to remind you that the church does not condone this. Sex is only for reproduction. It is a sin to use contraception, and we want to remind you not to go anywhere near these new doctors and not to think about trying these new prescriptions. And the next day at the clinics, the lines would be even longer.
So there's no such thing as bad publicity.
Exactly. Well, the point is, and this is, I think, a really important point. You know, we talk about how these doctors are really sexist. They don't really care about the side effects and how they affect women. They're totally focused on the bottom line here. But what's really happening is that women are starting to demand this. They don't know yet how safe it is. They don't know if it's really going to work, if it's ever going to be approved.
But they're desperate.
But they're desperate, and they're sending this message to Pincus and to Rock and to the drug companies that are starting to keep an eye on these experiments, that we want something like this. We're desperate for it, and letters are starting to come in. Pincus at one point goes to Japan and makes a speech at a Planned Parenthood conference and says, the pill is here. We've got it. We've figured it out. And John Rock is horrified. He says, you can't do that. We've only tested it on 60 women. How can you announce that we've done it, you can't declare victory when we've only tested it on 60 women? But Pincus does it anyway, and suddenly women all over the United States are going to their doctors saying, I've heard about this pill that's been developed, and I want it now. And this is really important because it sends the message that the government may not be ready for this, the church may not be ready for it, but American women are ready for it. If it works, they're going to take it.
Now, you mentioned the side effects, and the side effects were serious with these first iterations of the pill. You also mentioned that Pincus maybe wasn't taking it very seriously. He does seem to be incredibly dismissive of the side effects and even theorizes that it's just in the women's heads.
Yeah, he does. He thinks maybe it's all just in their heads, and he does an experiment to try to prove that. I should also mention that he's giving the pill to his daughter and to other members of his family because he thinks that even if the side effects are real, even if it's causing nausea, it's safe. Nobody's going to die from this. And it's more important that they have control of their bodies. And if they want to endure the side effects, because getting pregnant is a pretty serious has some pretty serious side effects too, then that's a choice women should be able to make. And he's so is it arrogant? Yeah, maybe it is. But again, it's also brave. You know, there's a fine line between bravery and arrogance.
So he finds a solution. And maybe not a final solution. Birth control pills today have side effects, but he finds a solution that lessens the side effects significantly. But he finds that solution completely by accident. And that is the addition of estrogen to the progesterone in the pills. But how did that even come about?
It was really one of those great lucks of great strokes of luck. They're testing the pill in Puerto Rico, and all of a sudden, and Pincus is studying the side effects. He's keeping track of them because you have to do that for the FDA approval if you're ever going to get FDA approval. And he notices that that 1 month the reports of side effects are greatly reduced, that for some reason all of a sudden they're not getting as many complaints. And he writes to Searle and says, do me a favor and check that last batch. Searle is the drug company that's agreed to provide him with the progesterone that he needs for these experiments. And they've done it quietly. They're asking not to have their name attached to it because they don't want to be associated with it if it goes bad. But he writes to Searle and says, just test that last batch for me and see if there's anything different about it. And they write back and they're horrified that accidentally the pill had been contaminated with a tiny amount of estrogen. And they don't know how it happened. It was an error. They're apologetic. But Pinka says, well, let's try that again. Send me another batch with the estrogen, with just a trace of estrogen in there. And sure enough, it turns out that this helps cut down on some of the side effects. So that becomes the formula that Pinka sticks with. And in fact, the formula that most birth control pills today contain.
So at this point, they've found, they believe, that the pill is effective. They want to move forward with FDA approval, but they still have a relatively small sample. And they are sending this application to the FDA for approval. Pinkus is beefing up the statistics. And instead of talking about the number of women who've participated in the study, he's talking about the number of menstrual cycles that have been studied in the study to make the whole thing seem so much bigger than it is. But they do get approval in 1957, but not for birth control. What was the pill approved for first?
It was approved for regulating women's menstrual cycles. So again, it sounds a little sneaky, and it is. But it's also they're doing this any way they can. It's one step at a time. They have nothing like this has ever been tried before. So there's no track to follow. There's no way to know what's right and what's going to work. So they're taking baby steps. And instead of going to the FDA and asking for something really radical, the world's first oral contraceptive, really the world's first designer drug, a drug that's meant to change a lifestyle, not to cure an illness. Instead of doing that, they say, well, we think this thing will help women have more regular periods. And a lot of women have irregular periods, so this could be really good for them. And that's a lot less of a hurdle to get over. It's still pretty unusual, and the FDA takes a long time to decide on this. And as you mentioned, they've only tested this for on 130 women, but Pinkus is trying to hide that by calling it 1,300 menstrual cycles. And the FDA finally approves it, but they have one condition. And that the condition is that the bottles have to contain a warning so that women know that this pill will also prevent pregnancy.
Which makes a lot of women ask their doctors if they could have help regulating their menstrual cycles, right?
Oh, yeah. Suddenly that's a big problem women are having. Everybody's going to their doctors and saying, my cycle's really irregular. And who can deny it, right? Anybody who wants it now can get it. And that's really the key, because American women start to respond to this. They're going to their doctors in massive numbers. Doctors are even calling some of their patients and saying, I have something here you might be interested in. And it is it just takes off. It
wow.
It goes viral, to use a modern term.
I'm talking with Jonathan Eich. He's the author of The Birth of the Pill, How Four Crusaders Reinvented Sex and Launched a Revolution. And again, to put this in perspective, that was in 1957 that the FDA approved the drug for the regulation of menstrual cycles. In 1958, 17 states still had laws banning the sale, distribution, or even advertisement of contraceptives.
That's right. It was, it was one of those examples where human behavior is way ahead of the law, and just as we've seen with gay marriage. The human behavior ends up setting a precedent. The law figures out a way to follow, and it's not until 1965 that the U.S. Supreme Court finally rules that women have a right to birth control. But that's after the birth control pill has already been on the market for 5 years as a birth control pill and 8 years off label. So it's really an important example of women fighting for what they want and need and making the law come around to their way of thinking.
So this had been, this last part of the journey was about 10 years. On May 9th, 1960, the birth control pill was approved by the FDA for its intended use as a contraceptive. And at this point, you know, all of these people had been working together for a decade. We know a little bit about how this affected society. How did Margaret Sanger respond? She's an old lady at this time. She's not very popular. She's gotten to the point. She's having some mental troubles. When she makes public appearances, they go very, very poorly. What did it mean to her when the pill was approved?
I think it was the culmination of her life's work. I think she was absolutely elated and vindicated. And in a fabulous interview with Newsweek right before she died, she said, "See, I told you so." And it was a woman reporter who came to visit her. I think that's really important to note. And Catherine McCormick, one of my favorite stories, at the age of 90, calls her doctor and asks for a prescription for birth control and goes to the pharmacy and fills that prescription. She just wants to feel it in her own hands. She wants to see for herself that this really worked.
Wow. And Catherine McCormick, there's another great story there. After this success, she and Sanger continued to correspond, and Sanger kind of makes a joke, you know, "What are you working on now?"
Yeah,
and Catherine doesn't take it as a joke. She's like, "Oh, I have these things."
That's right. She actually went on to the next mission, which was to get more women enrolled at MIT, and she built the first women's dorm at MIT. So these women were really incredible.
How about Gregory Pincus? What happened to him?
Pincus was the youngest of the four and the first to die, sadly. He died of blood poisoning, perhaps from having worked so many years in these makeshift laboratories where he was exposed to so many bizarre chemicals. But he did live long enough to see the pill start to spread across the world. And, you know, he really got into this for practical reasons, to prove that it could be done. He was not, motivated the way Sanger was by helping women at first. But he quickly began to see how important this was and how it was changing lives. And he really devoted a lot of his last years to traveling around the world and trying to get more countries to adopt the birth control pill. And I think had he lived a few years longer, he might have been recognized with a Nobel Prize for Science, because he certainly deserved it.
And there is some evidence that he may have even had cancer when the pill was approved.
Yeah, he was starting to show symptoms. And I think he knew and hid it from his colleagues because he wanted to finish his work as much as he could.
Now, Dr. John Rock didn't feel that his work was done. He wanted to convince the Catholic Church that the birth control pill was something that Catholic women should also have access to. And he worked very hard on that. How did he do that?
He did. He traveled to the Vatican. He met with Catholic Church leaders. And you know, some of them thought he was evil, that he was a sinner, that he should be excommunicated. But he actually made the argument and got pretty far. He actually met with bishops and other church leaders and said, you know, this is really just an extension of the rhythm method. It's modern science allowing women to control their bodies and to figure out when it's safe to have sex. And if women can have sex when they know they can't reproduce, that should not be considered a sin in the eyes of the church. And a committee appointed by the Pope actually voted along with Rock that the Vatican should accept the birth control pill. And the Pope vetoed their suggestion, and Rock died very frustrated that he was never able to convince his church to come around to his way of thinking.
Although he was also proud of his contributions.
No doubt. They changed millions and millions of lives.
Jonathan Eig, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Jonathan Eig is the author of The Birth of the Pill, How Four Crusaders Reinvented Sex and Launched a Revolution. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Claire Roth, Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Julia Davis. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can send us email anytime. We'd love to hear your suggestions for things you'd like to hear on the show, people you'd like to hear interviewed on the show. talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow is Horticulture Day. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.